All right, welcome back to the Deep Dive. Today we're going deep on a Fourth Amendment case, a big one.
Yeah.
United States versus Robinson. This one came out of the Fourth Circuit back in 2017.
Yeah, Robinson.
Really gets at, I think, a question a lot of us have.
Yeah.
Like, where does, you know, my right to be secure in my person, in my stuff, where does that end? And where does law enforcement's need to keep everybody safe, especially when guns are involved, where does that begin? So for our law students out there, and this is definitely something you might see on the bar exam, this case really digs into Terry versus Ohio, that whole stop and frisk world.
Yeah, good old Terry.
Right. And we're looking at this constant push and pull between, you know what am I allowed to do? What are my freedoms?
Mm.
Versus what can the police do to keep everybody safe? And so the big question I guess we're trying to unpack today is, if I'm legally allowed to have a gun, you know, what's the standard? What does a police officer need to be able to frisk me, you know, pat me down, search for a weapon during a lawful stop?
Yeah, I mean, Robinson really kind of messes with what a lot of people think is a pretty straightforward situation. You know, if I'm legally allowed to carry a gun, does that mean a cop can never be reasonably suspicious that I'm dangerous during a stop? You know, like, does that just erase all suspicion? And so we have to kind of go back to Terry, which you mentioned, Terry versus Ohio and all the rules that come out of that case. And of course, it's kind of a mess because, you know, gun laws vary so much from state to state these days. But, you know, like you said, Terry lays out this rule that basically police officers, they can stop someone, detain them briefly if they have this reasonable suspicion that the person's involved in criminal activity. And then there's this other layer, right? They can frisk someone if they have reasonable suspicion to think that that person is armed and dangerous. So, you know, the big question here in this case is, does being legally armed, like you said, does that just wipe out the dangerous part of that equation when a police officer is, you know, interacting with somebody on the street?
Okay, so let's get into how this actually went down in Robinson. So this whole thing started with an anonymous tip in Ranson, West Virginia.
Okay.
And this isn't exactly, you know, the safest place in the world. The court record describes it as kind of a high crime area known for drug trafficking.
Got it.
So the tipster, they called in and said there was a black male in a bluish greenish Toyota Camry, and that this guy had just loaded a firearm, hit it on himself, concealed it, and then gotten into the car.
Okay, so right off the bat, we've got this anonymous tip. And like anyone who's, you know, studied Fourth Amendment law knows, anonymous tips, those are tricky, right? How do we know if we can trust the person making the call? I mean, are they just making stuff up? You know, the courts look for what they call indicia of reliability. So did the tipster actually give, like, really specific details about the person, about what they were doing, details that, you know, maybe an average person wouldn't know, details that suggest maybe they have some insider information?
Right, like they're really there, they're really seeing it.
Yeah. Right, exactly. And did the police, did they actually see anything themselves that backed up what the tipster was saying? So, for example, you know, if the tipster says, hey, there's this guy and he's got, you know, he's wearing a red hat and he's got a blue bag and he's standing on this particular corner, and then the cops show up and lo and behold, there's a guy there wearing a red hat and carrying a blue bag. Well, okay, now we've got something, you know, that corroborates,
yeah,
that kind of gives more weight to what the tipster's saying.
Yeah, yeah.
A tip that gives real-time information. You know, this is happening right now, that's generally seen as more reliable than a tip that's kind of vague or maybe refers to something that happened a while ago. But if all you've got is basically like an accusation with no real details, no corroboration, then usually that's not going to be enough to create reasonable suspicion.
Got it. So in this case, the cops, they found the Camry and they pulled the car over for a seatbelt violation, which is, you know, a totally legal reason to stop a car.
Right. A pretextual stop, but
yeah,
still legal.
Exactly. So the passenger in the car was Shaquille Robinson. And when Robinson got out of the car, one of the officers said that he gave this weird look. Another officer described it as an oh crap kind of expression. So now you've got the tip about the gun, you've got this high crime area, and you've got Robinson acting, you know, maybe a little suspicious, according to the officers.
Right.
So the officers decided to frisk him, to pat him down. And what do you know? They found a loaded gun in his pocket. And as it turns out, Robinson was a convicted felon. So now he's being arrested under federal law, right? Because felons can't possess firearms.
Right, right. So that's where the legal battle really heats up. You know, Robinson's lawyers come in and they're like, whoa, 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 hold on a second. That frisk was illegal.
Yeah.
And that led to this whole motion to suppress the gun as evidence. They wanted to keep that gun out of the trial, you know, because they argued it was the fruit of the poisonous tree. So the district court, They sided with the police. They said, you know, you put it all together. You've got the tip. You've got the location. You've got Robinson's reaction. That all adds up to enough reasonable suspicion for the officers to believe that he was armed and dangerous. It's like, okay, maybe each of those things on their own, it wouldn't be enough. But you look at the whole picture.
Right. The totality of the circumstance.
Exactly. Exactly.
So that's it then, right? Case closed.
Oh, no, no, not even close. This thing went all the way up the ladder. So Robinson, he appealed that decision. And you know what? A 3-judge panel on the Fourth Circuit, they actually reversed the district court. They agreed with Robinson. They basically said, look, just because you think someone might have a gun, even if you got a tip, that doesn't mean you automatically get to frisk them, you know, especially in states where it's legal to carry a firearm. But hold on, there's more. The government, they weren't happy with that decision, so they went and asked for what's called an en banc rehearing.
Okay, now, I vaguely remember this from law school. What exactly does that mean? En banc.
So en banc, it basically means all the active judges on that circuit court, in this case, the Fourth Circuit, they all get together, like the whole gang, to reconsider the case. It's not just like a little 3-judge panel anymore.
So they're bringing out the big guns.
Yeah, exactly. And you know what? In a real plot twist, the en banc court, they actually reversed the panel's decision. They sided with the district court, which means, you know, they upheld Robinson's conviction.
Wow.
Yeah, so it's a real back and forth. And one important thing to remember here is that Robinson had originally pleaded guilty, but he did it conditionally. That means he reserved the right to appeal the specific issue of whether that frisk was legal or not.
I see. So that's why this whole thing even went up on appeal in the first place.
Exactly. He was basically saying, okay, I'll plead guilty for now, but I still want to fight this frisk issue because if I win, the whole case could get thrown out.
Got it. So let's really break down that full court decision, the en banc majority opinion written by Judge Niemeyer. What were the key arguments there that persuaded most of the Fourth Circuit?
Well, the heart of their argument was that, look, whenever you have a police officer interacting with someone and there might be a gun involved, there's just inherent risk whether or not that gun is legally owned. Like, just having a gun in the situation changes things. And Judge Niemeyer, he said something pretty important, definitely worth highlighting in your notes. He said, the Fourth Amendment does not require officers to take unnecessary risks. So the way they saw it was when you've got a police stop, which is already kind of a forced interaction, right? You're not really free to just walk away. And then you throw a gun into the mix. Well, that just ramps up the danger level for everyone involved. And the fact that the person might have a permit for the gun, it doesn't just magically make that risk go away. The officer on the scene, they still have to make these split-second life or death decisions about their own safety.
Yeah. I mean, if you think about it from the officer's perspective, they're in this tense situation. You know, adrenaline's pumping, you've got a possible weapon, they have to react quickly.
Absolutely, you know, and they have to think about protecting not only themselves, but also any bystanders who might be around.
Right, right. So what about the concurring opinion, Judge Wynn's concurrence? Did that kind of add anything new to this line of reasoning?
Yeah, so Judge Wynn, he basically doubled down on this whole inherent risk idea. He argued that even if you've got someone who's legally carrying a firearm, they still present what he called a categorical risk to police officers during these kinds of stops. He was basically saying, look, just the fact that a gun is present means there's always a chance things could escalate and turn violent. And that baseline risk, that's enough to justify a frisk as long as the officer has reasonable suspicion to believe the person's armed. For him, it wasn't really about whether the gun was legal or not. It was about the potential for danger that a gun brings to any police interaction.
Okay, so a lot of emphasis on officer safety in these opinions. But as with most, you know, legal issues, we got another perspective here. We've got the dissent written by Judge Harris. So what was her main beef with what the majority decided?
Yeah, Judge Harris, she was worried, really worried, that this decision, what the majority had decided, that it could chip away at those Fourth Amendment protections. And she was especially concerned about people in states where carrying a gun is totally legal. Her big point was, simply having a gun, like just possessing it, shouldn't automatically make you seem dangerous in the eyes of the law. She was concerned this would open the door to cops routinely frisking people who are doing nothing wrong, who are just exercising their Second Amendment rights, especially in those states with looser gun laws. She thought the majority was basically making it too easy for officers to justify a frisk in these situations.
Right, right. So this really brings us back to that tension we were talking about at the beginning, you know, our rights versus the need for safety.
Absolutely. It's like, how do you strike that balance? Where do you draw the line?
Yeah. And this might be a good time to just, for any of our listeners who are maybe new to law school or just, need a refresher, can we just talk for a minute about the difference between reasonable suspicion and probable cause? These terms come up all the time when we talk about the Fourth Amendment, and I know they get kind of confusing.
Yeah, for sure. Happy to clarify. So think of it like a spectrum of certainty that police officers need to have before they can do certain things. At one end, you've got probable cause, which is the higher standard. That means there's enough solid evidence to believe a crime's been committed or is about to happen. You need probable cause to arrest someone or to get a warrant to do a full-blown search. Reasonable suspicion sits lower on that spectrum. It means an officer knows specific facts that, when you put them all together, would lead a reasonable person to suspect criminal activity might be afoot and that the person they've stopped might be armed and dangerous. So it's not just a hunch or a feeling, it has to be based on something concrete. It's just that the level of certainty is lower than probable cause.
Okay, that's a helpful way to think about it.
Yeah, and Terry v. Ohio. That's the case that really carved out this whole reasonable suspicion exception. It said, okay, police can do a brief investigatory stop based on reasonable suspicion that criminal activity is going on. And then they can also do a separate pat down, a frisk, if they have reasonable suspicion to believe the person's armed and dangerous. So it's not just about whether they have a weapon, it's about whether they pose a threat.
Right. So in this case, in Robinson, the Fourth Circuit said, yeah, the reasonable suspicion for that frisk, it came from that combination of factors we've been talking about. The tip, the high crime area, and Robinson's reaction when he got out of the car.
Exactly. And it's interesting because, the initial reason for the stop was just the seatbelt violation, right?
Right.
So that gave them a legal basis to stop the car. But then the question became, did all this other stuff add up to enough reasonable suspicion that Robinson was not only armed, but also dangerous, which would then allow them to do the frisk? And the en banc majority said yes, looking at, what they called the totality of the circumstances. Like, you got to look at the whole picture.
Got it. So let's circle back to the anonymous tip for a minute. You mentioned earlier that the reliability of that tip is really important. So, what are the things that make a tip reliable enough to factor into this reasonable suspicion analysis?
Yeah, so courts look for what they call indicia of reliability, which basically means, are there signs that this tip is legit? So, did the tipster give really detailed information about the person, what they were doing, what they were wearing? Were those details things that maybe an average person wouldn't know that suggest this person really has some inside knowledge? And then, crucially, did the police see anything themselves that matched up with what the tipster said? Like I was saying before, if the tipster says this guy's wearing a red hat, blue bag, standing on this corner, and the police see that, well, that makes the tip more believable. And a tip that's happening in real time, like this is happening right now, that's usually considered more reliable than something vague or that refers to something that happened a long time ago. But a tip that's just an accusation without details, without anything to back it up, that's usually not going to cut it on its own.
That makes sense. So, how about the fact that this happened in a high crime area? So we hear that phrase a lot in Fourth Amendment cases. What role does that play in the analysis?
Right, good question. The Supreme Court has actually weighed in on this, most notably in a case called Illinois v. Wardlow. So, being in a high crime area, that's definitely something officers can consider when they're deciding if they have reasonable suspicion or not. The logic there is, in places where there's a lot of crime happening, it's statistically more likely that you're going to encounter someone who's up to no good. But, and this is really important, simply being in a high crime area, that by itself is not enough to justify stopping someone or frisking them. It's just one piece of the puzzle, one factor among many that the police have to take into account. They've got to look at the big picture, the totality of the circumstances.
All right, now let's be super clear about something here, because I think this is where some people might misinterpret what Robinson actually means. So, does this ruling mean that the police can now just frisk anyone they stop if that person happens to be carrying a gun legally?
No,
definitely not. That's a huge misunderstanding. Robinson does not give police free rein to just frisk anyone who's got a gun during a stop. It's not a free-for-all. The key is that there still has to be a lawful stop in the first place. So the police need a valid reason to stop you in the first place, like a traffic violation or something.
Right.
And then on top of that, there's got to be this separate showing of reasonable suspicion that the person is not just armed, but also dangerous. Remember, it's armed and dangerous. The court's decision in Robinson, it was really based on that specific set of facts in the case. You had the anonymous tip with all those details, the high crime area, Robinson's reaction. Without that extra stuff that suggests there might be a threat, if all you've got is a legally possessed firearm, then a frisk based just on that, that probably would still violate the Fourth Amendment.
Okay, that's a crucial point. So zooming out a little bit, what's the lasting impact of the Robinson decision? What kind of precedent does it set?
Well, I think it's safe to say that Robinson definitely makes it easier for law enforcement to justify their actions in situations like this, especially when you have an anonymous tip that's corroborated by what the officers see and the context of the stop, you know, the location, the person's behavior, all that. It also sends a message, at least within the Fourth Circuit, that just because someone's allowed to own a gun under state law, that doesn't mean the officer can't be reasonably suspicious that they're dangerous during a lawful stop. The focus is really on what's happening in that moment. You know, are there immediate safety risks for the officers and the people around them?
And how does this case, how does it fit into the bigger constitutional picture? Especially when you think about the Second Amendment and that whole emphasis on the right to bear arms that we see in cases like Heller.
Yeah, I mean, that's the million-dollar question, right? Cases like Heller really affirmed that individual right to have a gun. But we've always known that right has limits, right? Like, you can't just do anything you want with a gun. And Robinson shows us how the courts are trying to balance that fundamental right with the very real need for police officers to stay safe in these sometimes dangerous situations. I think we're going to keep seeing cases like this pop up all over the country, and it wouldn't surprise me if the Supreme Court eventually steps in to give us some more clarity, especially if different circuits start reaching different conclusions on this issue. That's how a lot of these big constitutional questions end up at the Supreme Court, you know, when you've got these circuit splits.
Right. So to wrap this up, what's the key takeaway here for our listeners, particularly those of you who are really diving deep into constitutional law?
I think the main point to remember is that the courts tend to give a lot of weight to officer safety, especially during traffic stops where things can be unpredictable and potentially dangerous. And that's true even if the person involved is legally allowed to have a gun. You know, Robinson really underscores how fact-specific these Fourth Amendment analyses are. It's all about the totality of the circumstances. Do those specific facts add up to a reasonable suspicion of danger? And just having a legal gun, that doesn't automatically take away that potential danger in the eyes of the law, at least not when you're talking about police interactions.
Yeah, I think that's a great point to end on. This has been a really fascinating look at a super important Fourth Amendment case. And, you know, before we sign off, just a little something to chew on. Think about a state where people have a clear right to carry a firearm. What else would you need to see? What additional evidence, beyond the fact that someone has a gun during a lawful stop, what would it take for you to say, yeah, that pushes it over the line to reasonable suspicion of danger? Like, is it just their behavior? Is it something about the situation they're in? That's a debate that's going on right now in courtrooms and in legal scholarship, and it's going to shape how we understand our rights and the powers of law enforcement for years to come. So, something to ponder. Thanks for joining us on the Deep Dive.
Thanks for having me.